This is for Mr. Fox. I was just wondering why you said that the second part, or the third part of the Anthropocene was in the 90s rather than in the 70s, when Earth Day and all of the awareness started.
Yeah, that's a great question. And so it's interesting because none of these boundaries are clear-cut. They're sort of gray areas or ecotones of cultural understanding of what's going on. So in trying to figure out what Will Stephan in Australia and Paul Creighton and these other folks at Georgetown University have done in separating out those three stages, what I'm trying to do is figure out, what do you guys mean? I mean, in the 1970s, there was an awareness of, I mean, we knew what Earth System Sciences were, and we knew what ecology was, and we knew that these things were all interlinked. And their response is, yeah, but we didn't know. We knew we were affecting these changes in the planet, but we didn't know that we could take responsibility and change the nature of our effect. It wasn't widespread. There was a certain number of people who knew that, but it wasn't widespread. So that was their definition of how that third stage started in the 90s. Yeah. And I, like I said, I think it's very gray. So, yeah.
So it was the awareness of our need for taking responsibility?
Yeah, and it was a widespread awareness throughout the culture. It wasn't just people in universities or whatever, it was, you know, just people walking around. You know, that's how they set that up. Yeah, no, I think, yeah, slightly, yeah.
Hi, thank you, you guys, everybody. Lucy, I have a question for you. In your compound, I'll call it that, are you self-sustaining? Are you able to, or do you create other objects that go into the other marketplace other than just the art world or art context?
At the moment we have our studio, the Dairy, and we're making exclusively art objects. That's all we're making. And we wanted to regenerate the factories through contemporary art. And when we discovered that the Dairy was going to be too small, then we began the process of acquiring the other mills along the river with this idea that it could become a much larger complex and that we could begin to share this complex with other people. So that's when the gallery moved in, and then there's obviously a project there for the showing and developing of audiences around contemporary art. I was telling one of your colleagues here that our neighbours have never been to Paris. It's only 15 miles away. So there's a huge audience development, a huge learning basis to be established around art, obviously even contemporary art in general. So that's been a huge project that we've been running right from the beginning through the opening up of our studios and open days and then bringing in the gallery, etc. So first of all, being able to make work, being able to show work, and then the third phase, if you like, which we began working quite a long while ago, but we're now opening it up, is the International Residency Programme. So bringing artists in from around the world to create work in situ and work together with communities around the location. So at the moment, it would be just dedicated to contemporary art, but with the possibilities, as you can see, the location is huge, and we're inviting other people to come into it now, so to develop it in other areas. And it's a brownfield site, so we've done a lot of work landscaping just to bring back some of the nature that had been completely destroyed. So we've started with landscaping and planting trees, because obviously that takes time to grow. The last 3 years have been doing that, and we've just brought electricity into some of the buildings, and we don't have any water yet, even though we're on a river, which seems absolutely crazy. So we've got to work out a system to be able to bring water in so that we can actually begin to live there all year round.
I have a question, Bill, for you. I'm very intrigued by this concept of working with the Harrisons in terms of a 50-year in the future commitment in the Sierra project. And I'm wondering, well, A, this is the first time that you know of the museum has made this kind of commitment to an artist into the future. And how does it actually pragmatically work when you and your staff?
Yeah, we're no longer there.
Theoretically,
yeah.
Might not be here at that time.
Right.
So
right.
How does it actually plan for?
Yeah. You know, as far as we know, we are the only museum to make a commitment of that length to a project of this nature. And it's predicated upon an ongoing generation of archival material that comes to us, and an ongoing real-time data presentation or visualization of some kind that will have a physical presence in the museum. So if that's a flat screen in a library that shows what's going on each growing season, for example, that would not be a bad way to do that. The nice thing is that there are two institutions involved, really. It's three. There's a UC Santa Cruz Center for the Force Majeure, which is the Harrisons have set up and endowed. And then there's a UC Berkeley, the research station, and then there's our museum. So we think, between all three of us, that we can keep it going for 50 years. That's the hope. It's definitely an experiment. It may not work at all, but we're really, and it's codified in documents and all this other stuff. So hopefully it's going to work, yeah.
Maybe in terms of mortality, exceptions will be made in your case.
One would like to think so, but it's a nice thought.
Hello, I'm Billy Sheehan-Spell here at Cornell Anthropology, and I live in a small community just adjacent to the campus, and we were planning a meal with music and it features sustainability in local production. But is there a way that we could connect, or I could see this replicated in smaller ways, the meals that I love, the way you organize the communal meals, is there a way that we could be guided by your process and reproduce that on a very small scale?
Absolutely. An idea just comes to mind, but I think when we've staged this community meal in Diocese, images that I showed you, which was such a huge success, it was a 3,000 population, we had 1,500 turn up, which is major because nothing like this had ever happened in the community. And some of the community members said to us, well, why produce the plates? That's expensive, right? And we said, well, no, we don't want paper plates. We don't want the waste, first of all, and we think those are going to be the important elements of that meal that are going to remind people that it's happened afterwards. And the proof was that they were sold. So 750 plates sold on that day to the farmers, to the miners, to the local immigrant population, all of the community, the ex-servicemen that turned up for that meal. So one element is to think about, yes, how, what are the signifiers, what are the elements that that bind people together around the tablecloth, the table setting, the objects, and how do those objects then diffuse back into the community, become part of people's lives. So, yeah, we have to think. You can have people making plates too. We've not tried that yet, but I think that's also a wonderful way to engage people in the process of making the designing the ware for the table.
That's a great idea. Consulting your website would give us some guidance, you think?
I have a frequently asked question, FAQ. I have a FAQ sheet to send out. But it's for absolutely, we can share. We can share the methods with you, absolutely.
There's some other groups that do this too. So Jim Denneman, who does a project called Outstanding in the Field, with Long, and so there's guidance around for you to find out how to do this.
Yeah.
Lucy's the top of the spectrum, the biggest ones.
Over 10,000 people we've had around our tables.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
So I have a question. You know, you've talked about the fact that, you know, sometimes I think you were saying that when projects begin, the artists often don't know exactly what they're investigating, and they know they're investigating something, but they, you know, the disappearance of something, something's changed, so they're kind of documenting conditions or beginning an exploration. And you yourself have begun many explorations, but not knowing, you know, it's an evolution, right? So when it comes to the artist being able to actually kind of fund that exploration, you know, how have you seen that unfolding for artists to be able to, in real time, you know, conduct investigations and also kind of like feed themselves, and, you know, they didn't have the money to conduct that exploration. That's kind of a vague question, but I'm just sort of, is it because there is such a long period of time that many of these projects have to occur over? And so I'm just kind of curious that what in each, you know, in the projects you described and in some of what you were talking about, each of you, I'm curious to know what you know about that sort of pragmatic piece of it.
Well, let me say a couple of things. Regarding Mary Miss, who I have followed for some time, she's done two things after being disgusted about the constructions of her projects formerly for either public art projects for either shopping malls or even governmental agencies. She established a nonprofit. She's presently doing a project called 1,000 Steps. It's part of her larger project, City as Living Laboratory, in which she's going to put ecozone markers along the length of the street in Manhattan, Broadway, which goes from about 145th down to the bottom of the water. And so she established a legal nonprofit to do that over a period of years. She has not put a single one up yet permanently. She started through that. And that enabled people to give donations to her through the nonprofit. And secondly, a source for her has been the National Science Foundation. Under their programs of education of the public of science. So essentially, the art world itself, of course, even within the art world, you know, I mean, there aren't really grants to artists, hardly. And the art world isn't really funding, isn't really showing her work so much at all. So although she did show some of this at the Noguchi Museum for another kind of very local design project. So it is about creative funding, but to the extent that this is about science and environment situations, they look to those agencies who are delighted to have artists serve as visualizers and marketers for science.
No single answer. I mean, you know, you already know the answers, right? It's everything. You work a second job, you get a little grant, you do a Kickstarter campaign, you start a nonprofit. It's every idea you've ever heard of.
So. Yeah, I think there is a light at the end of the tunnel there, so you're working towards that. And there are small shafts of light come into that tunnel as you're going along. So small pots of funding, you know, get you to that end goal. So it's about having that end goal, which is important.
Yeah, and this question gets asked at almost every talk I go to. Because people are so keen to do this work.
Right, yeah. Nobody's sort of, you know, nobody's sort
no,
of...
There is no one big solution.
The Rauschenberg Foundation is just conducting a lengthy, somewhat confused conversation about how to maybe intervene in this. We'll see if they come up with something interesting.
That'd be great, yeah.
And we always say that one plus one equals million, so it's, you know, there's multiples that add up to the big number at the end.
That's right. Mark Rauschenberg just funded a series this past fall called Marfa.
Marfa Dialogue.
Marfa Dialogue. So the Marfa organization in Texas is another